we also have with us the chairman of the committee, Mr. Landers, also Mr. Landers, who will also do the introduction on the judicial matters second amendment and judicial matters third amendment. And without, maybe before handing over to him, I will allow members to introduce themselves and the leader of the Team Credit Department to also introduce the delegation. My name is Chetan Mofuge. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development.
Tunga Mantila, a member of the committee from Gauteng.
Lewins Mande from the City of Choice, Nsunduzi, KZN, member of the committee.
Yeah, good morning, Chair, and good morning, everybody. My name is Dennis Bloom from Free State. The town is Kroonstad.
Morning, Chair. Morning, everybody. My name is John Gunda. I'm from the Northern Cape called, and from the town called Upington.
Goedemorgen, mijn naam is Jacques Becker, ik is van die weeskap, maar ik kom eigenlijk van Oudschool vanaf. Dank u.
Morning, everybody. I'm Veli Makasana Manzini, member of this committee. I'm from Mpumalanga, the beautiful province. Thank you.
Good morning. Kamala Mungong Senzulu. I come from the Kingdom of KwaZulu-Natal.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. I'm Lawrence Bassett from the Department of Justice, Legislative Development, and the people, my colleagues that are joining me here today, Mr. Raj Dyer, sitting at the back behind me, and Ms. Lorna Lowe, they are here to assist with the legal practice bill. We worked as a team throughout the development of this bill to date. Advocate Javis Kosano is also part of that. Fortunately, he is not able to be here, and he asked me to tender apologies on his behalf. And then we also have Mr. Cyril Robertson from the department, and he's here to assist with the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill. Thank you.
So, good morning, Chair. I'm Kendra Blecker from the Northern Cape, and I'm a member of the committee. Thank you.
Other people can introduce yourself.
Good morning, I'm Christine Folkestone. I'm the Content Advisor with the Justice Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, I'm Helen Nesbitt. I'm a researcher with the Justice Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, Patricia Whittle. I'm the researcher for the Select Committee.
Without any waste of time, I'll hand over to the department for the briefing.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not too sure which order you want to do it, legal practice, or is Mr. Landers going to deal with the judicial matters first, the committee bills? I just appreciate your guidance.
I think I will start with the legal practice.
Chair, thank you very much. We did submit a document in PowerPoint presentation. I do realize it's a long document, but we did that with a view to making sure that the committee, this committee, has all the information I think that it would require, so we've gone into quite some detail. I understand we've got from 10 until 11:30 to do this presentation. I'm going to do part of the presentation, and my colleague, Ms. Lowe, is going to assist me with the last portion, and Mr. Dyer is also going to assist, particularly when questions arise, and to add anything that he feels that we should add. So if I may start, Chair, the legal practice bill was approved by the National Assembly on the 12th of November last week, and it was then referred to the NCOP, and I want to make the point that it is a Section 76 bill, so it will have to be dealt with in terms of sections, the procedure. procedure set out in terms of Section 76 of the Constitution, where the provincial legislatures play a role. Before getting into the bill, perhaps I should say up front as well, Chair, that the bill, its implementation, and I start right at the end, the implementation of this bill is a two-phase process. You've got chapters 1 to, I think it's 9, at the body of the bill, and then chapter 10 deals with transitional provisions and a body called the National Forum on the Legal Profession. I will deal with that in more detail, or my colleague will deal with that in more detail when we get to that portion of the bill, but I think it's important to realize that there is still work to be done, and the National Forum on the Legal Profession is there for a three-year period to put in place and to deal with issues in respect of which there hasn't been consensus on the bill to date. I also have to say up front that the bill has been long in the making, and it's been a difficult process, and in this process there have been efforts to try and get consensus between the various formations in the legal practice, in the legal profession, to come up with a consensus bill. There are, unfortunately, still issues outstanding, and the mandate of the National...
Chair, I think we don't have... there was an indication that there's a PowerPoint briefing document. We don't have it with us, and I'm not sure what's happening, because we want to follow the process.
Our government is going to find the documents.
Okay.
You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. We submitted that, I think, on Thursday, so I'm sure that is available. So, as I say, Chair, the mandate of this national forum is to sort out a number of issues where the different formations in the existing legal profession must get together and make recommendations to the minister. And those recommendations will largely be converted into regulations. Let me leave that there and then get into the body of the bill. Chair, the bill is intended to address the following: to rationalise the current fragmented legislative framework in terms of which the former RSA and the former Homeland laws are still in operation in the various parts of the country. You still have an Attorney's Act in the form of Botswana. You still have an Attorney's Act in the form of Venda, for instance, and you still have an Attorney's Act in the form of RSA. So this bill is going to regulate the entire legal profession in a single statute and repeal the outdated former RSA legislation and former Homeland legislation. The purpose of the bill is also to transform and restructure, or let's put it in another way, to democratize the regulatory bodies in the legal profession by establishing for the first time a single national body with provincial councils. The bill is also intended to broaden access to justice by making access to legal services easier in terms not only of affordability, but also one of the purposes of the bill is to enhance access to the legal profession. It is also there to promote and protect the public interest and to establish for the first time an office which is called an Office of the Legal Service Ombud. And it's also there to make the legal profession more accountable in terms of its disciplinary proceedings and the outcome thereof. I think it's important to stress and to realize that the bill does not bring about fusion of attorneys and advocates. As I say, the bill has a long history, and one of the earlier versions of the bill was to have a single legal profession called legal practitioners. The bill does not do that now. This is a result of concessions that have been made along the way. The bill continues to recognize the two existing categories of legal practitioners, that is, attorneys and advocates, each with their own areas of expertise. Those are the introductory provisions of the bill. I move now to Chapter 2, and this chapter establishes a single national South African Legal Practice Council. The council itself has numerous objectives, and that I'm not going to go through them all, but to mention a few, is the regulation of and jurisdiction over all legal practitioners. That is attorneys and advocates, candidate attorneys and pupils. Pupils are legal law graduates in training to become advocates. The council, another object of the council is to preserve and uphold the independence of the legal profession, to enhance and maintain the integrity and status of the legal profession, and to put in place appropriate standards of professional practice and ethical conduct, which will be applicable to all legal practitioners, this code of conduct. But it's important to note that the code of conduct will have to recognize the differences which advocates and attorneys go about their business. Another object of the council is to promote high standards of legal education and training and compulsory post-qualification professional development, promote access to the legal profession, similar to what the bill is about, and ensure accessible and sustainable training of law graduates. Clause 6 is a very long provision. It sets out the powers and functions of the council, and I don't intend to go through them all. It sets out extensively these powers and functions. For instance, clause 161 sets out the powers and functions which are necessary for the operation of the council. And let me just go through a few of these by way of example. It may acquire or hire movable or immovable property, may make donations, it may invest council funds, borrow or raise money, just to mention a few. That deals with the operations of the council. The council may also delegate any of its powers to its committees that it may establish or to the provincial councils. The council may provide financial support to organizations providing legal education and training, to non-profit organizations and to institutions promoting access to justice for poor people. The council must establish a mechanism to provide appropriate legal education and training, having due regard to our inherited legacy and the new constitutional dispensation. Training is recognized in the bill as a key transformational imperative. The council must report to the minister on its activities, with particular reference to measures to enhance access to justice, and the council must also advise the minister on multidisciplinary legal practices, with a view to promoting legislative and other interventions on these type of legal multidisciplinary legal practices. Multidisciplinary legal practices are your Deloitte's, your KPMG, and the like. Give a clause that in. But there's a particular provision in clause 7, in clause 6 that I would like to bring to the committee's attention. The council must report annually to the minister on the number of new candidate legal practitioners registered as such and the number of new legal practitioners enrolled as such. It must also, and this is probably the most very important aspect, must report on progress made on the implementation of programs contemplated in subsection 1B5 to empower historically disadvantaged legal practitioners and candidate legal practitioners. And what does section 6.1B5 say? The council must develop programs in order to empower historically disadvantaged legal practitioners as well as candidate legal practitioners, and it must report on progress made in that regard to the minister. So I think I'll step off the powers and functions of the council because it is a long provision and it is all pretty self-explanatory. Then the composition of the council, and I must say this is one of the has been one of the more difficult provisions, how it is composed and how many and who, and it is as follows. The council consists of 16 legal practitioners, 10 practicing attorneys, and 6 practicing advocates. And these legal 16 legal practitioners are elected by the profession itself in accordance with the procedure that is going to be determined. The council also consists of two legal academics designated by the various law faculties, three persons designated by the minister, and these three persons may not be public servants and may not be persons with party political affiliations, and they must be able to bring expertise and experience relating to the objects of the board. The council also consists of one person designated by Legal Aid South Africa and one person designated by the board of the Attorneys Fidelity Fund, or the Fidelity Fund is going to be called the Legal Practitioners Fidelity Fund, and I'll get to that later. As I say, that's been a difficult provision, and there have been calls, let me say up front, or questions have been raised. Why are there 10 practicing attorneys on the council and only 6 practicing advocates? And I think the answer lies, statistics that are available to us, there are approximately 20,000 attorneys and less than 5,000 advocates in the country. Another contentious clause has been contentious to date. The clause has been adapted, and that's clause 14, which gives the minister the power to dissolve the National Council in the event of it becoming dysfunctional. The clause has been adapted, and the minister, in terms of the adapted clause, the minister has the power to dissolve the council if it becomes dysfunctional, but there are qualifications only on authority of an order of the High Court. And the minister cannot go to the High Court until the Ombud has also investigated and made recommendations to the minister regarding the dysfunctionality or the alleged dysfunctionality of the council. And maybe I should just pause and read what that clause says. It's not long. And it reads as follows. If the minister loses confidence in the ability of the council to perform functions efficiently and effectively, the minister must provide the council with his or her reasons, give the council a reasonable opportunity to respond to those reasons, and afford the council a hearing on any submissions made. That's subclause 1. Subclause 2 says, if after taking the steps provided for in subsection 1, the minister still does not have the confidence and ability of the council to perform its functions effectively and efficiently, he or she must request the Ombud to conduct an investigation and make recommendations to him or her. Subclause 3 says, and this is the last that I'm going to read, if after receiving the recommendations from the Ombud, the minister still has concerns in the ability of the council to perform its functions effectively and efficiently, and the minister is of the view that it is in the best interests of the administration of justice that the council be dissolved, he or she must, in order to do so, approach the High Court with an application for an order dissolving the council, together with any terms or conditions that the court deems appropriate. The legal profession, that is the council and the board of the Fidelity Fund, is responsible for the financial implications arising from the implementation of the board. I think it's important to note that to date, and this is going to be retained, that the legal profession is responsible for its own funding. It's self-funding, and it's important that the legal profession continues to fund its regulatory bodies in the interests of the independence of the legal profession. However, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development will be responsible for the establishment and running of the Office of the Legal Services Ombud. Then I go on to the provincial councils. Clause 23 of the bill requires eventually the establishment of 9 provincial councils, one for each province. This is also an incremental approach is also envisaged, because to establish 9 provincial councils in one go might prove to be difficult. So the bill provides for the establishment of at least 4 provincial councils, which must be increased progressively as funds and capacity become available. Representation on these provincial councils, which will be legal practitioners, will be in proportion to the number of attorneys and advocates practicing in each of the provinces or areas of the jurisdiction of these provincial councils. Another important aspect of the provincial councils is that they have no original powers. All the powers are vested in the National Council, which, as I've said, can delegate these powers and functions and assign the functions down to the provincial councils. And the National Council, will delegate those powers to the provincial councils, which are best performed at provincial level. I could imagine it would be admissions to the legal profession and disciplinary matters. There might be others. The bill requires all persons who wish to practice as legal practitioners in the form of attorneys or advocates to be admitted by the High Court before they can start practicing. That is currently the position. Nothing changes there. And it's important that legal practitioners who are officers of the court be admitted by the court before they can start applying their trade. However, after they've been admitted by the court, there's another step that aspirant legal practitioners must go through. They must be enrolled or registered with the council. I'll deal with that in a bit more detail now. What are the requirements for a legal practitioner, an attorney or an advocate before he or she can be admitted by the court? They must be South African citizens, or they must have permanent residency status. That's the same as the current position. They must have obtained at least an LLB degree at a South African university. Provision is made for certain foreign legal practitioners to appear in our courts and to practice here, and that is to be found in Clause 24.3. And the reason for that particular provision is to accommodate South Africa's international obligations in terms of the GATS agreement, to which South Africa is a signatory and has international obligations. I might ask one of my colleagues to come back to that and deal with that in a bit more detail. What are the other criteria that must be complied with before a person can be admitted by a court as a legal practitioner? They must be fit and proper persons, as is the case with our judicial officers. They must have completed practical vocational training. What is practical vocational training? It's pupillage in the case of persons who want to become advocates, and it's articles of clerkship in the case of persons who want to become attorneys. What the practical vocational training in terms of pupillage and articles of clerkship will be is one of the mandates of the National Forum that I've already referred to. That forum must thrash out the form and content of practical vocational training for aspirant advocates and aspirant attorneys. The time periods, who does it, how it's done, how it's registered, how it's monitored, are all issues that the National Forum must have a look at. A further important new criteria for that must be complied with before a person can be admitted by the High Court is that during practical vocational training, these persons must undergo or perform community service. A portion of pupillage and a portion of articles of clerkship will be devoted to doing community service. This is a transformational aspect. Again, the details of this community service will be spelled out in regulations. How long, where can it be done, are all the issues that will be dealt with in the regulations. Maybe I should just pause here and say what the bill says, and that's in Clause 29. The minister must must, after consultation with the council, prescribe the requirements for community service from a date to be determined by the minister, and such requirements may include community service as a component of practical vocational training by candidate practitioners, or as a minimum period of recurring community service by legal practitioners upon which continued enrollment of the legal practitioner is dependent. So community service is not only intended for people undergoing pupillage or articles of clerkship, but also for admitted legal practitioners. What is community service? Besides what is going to be spelled out in the regulations, community service for the purposes of this section may include, but is not limited to, the following: service in the state, approved by the minister in consultation with the council; service at the South African Human Rights Commission; service without any remuneration as a judicial officer in the case of legal practitioners, including as a commissioner in the small claims courts; the provision of legal education and training on behalf of the council, on behalf of an academic institution or non-governmental organization, or any other service which the candidate legal practitioner or the legal practitioner may want to perform with the approval of the minister. I think it's also important to note that the council may, on application and good cause shown, exempt a legal practitioner from performing community service as set out in the rules. I think it's important to note that community service might prove challenging and difficult for some legal practitioners, especially if they have their one small businesses, one man small businesses, and the requirements to do community legal service might provide challenges. I've deviated a bit, Chair, to go into community service, but I return now to the criteria what applicants, the criteria that applicants must comply with in order to be admitted by the court. And the last one is they must have passed an admission exam, either for attorneys or advocates. At present, in terms of the Attorneys Act, all aspirant attorneys must pass that admission exam once they have completed articles of clerkship. That is not the case. It's not compulsory in the case of advocates. Advocates who do their pupillage, or persons who do their pupillage at the bar, one of the constituent bar councils, are required to do a bar exam, but that's not regulated by statute. So those are the criteria that any aspirant legal practitioner must comply with before being admitted by the courts. Admitted attorneys and advocates can practice throughout the country once they have been admitted and enrolled by, admitted by the courts and enrolled by the council. However, attorneys who want to appear in the superior courts, so that's your high courts, your Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court, must have been practicing for at least 3 years as attorneys before they can get the right to appear in our superior courts. And they must apply at the High Court for a certificate to get such right of appearance. That is the case at present, so it is no different really from the case at present. I'm skipping a few slides dealing with community service, Chair, because I've already dealt with that. I think it's also important to note what I've just said about the requirements before a court can admit an attorney or advocate. One of the implications thereof, important implication, is that advocates will no longer be able to be admitted as advocates purely on the strength of having an LLB degree. They are going to have to do practical vocational training in the form of pupillage. At present, you have people that qualify, they get their LLB degrees, they comply with the other requirements in terms of the Admission of Advocates Act, and they are admitted as advocates without having done any form of pupillage. As I've just said, the people at the constituent bars are required to do pupillage, but not all advocates go to the constituent bars. Then we get to enrollment. After that legal practitioner has been admitted as an advocate or an attorney, that person must then apply to the council, the National Council, for enrollment or escorted registration with the council. They cannot practice as legal practitioners until they have been enrolled with the council after paying the required fee. Chair, this is really not too different from the existing provision, because in terms of the Attorneys Act, attorneys are enrolled on a roll of attorneys, and that roll of attorneys is kept by the registrars of the High Courts. In the case of advocates at present, advocates are enrolled after being admitted by the High Courts on a roll of advocates. The roll of advocates at present is kept and maintained by the Director General, Justice and Constitutional Development in terms of the Admission of Advocates Act. The bill envisages a centralized role of legal practitioners, which will be kept, compiled, and maintained by the National Council. I now go on to Clause 32 of the bill, which deals with conversion of enrollment. And this is also a new aspect, and I think it's a transformational aspect. A legal practitioner who has been admitted and enrolled as an attorney or advocate may convert his or her enrollment from that of an attorney to an advocate and vice versa. That gives a certain amount of flexibility and enables legal practitioners to change direction should they so wish, and make it easier to go that route. A similar conversion of enrollment is provided for in the case of advocates who practice with Fidelity Fund certificates and who thereafter wish to practice without a Fidelity Fund certificate. I'm going to talk about that in far greater detail, about advocates who practice with and advocates who practice without Fidelity Fund certificates. But Clause 32 does allow for a conversion by advocates who want to change their form of conducting their practices. Clause 33 deals with authority to render legal services. And it's important because it provides that no person other than a legal practitioner who has been admitted and is and enrolled as such may, in expectation of any fee, appear in any court or before any board, tribunal, or similar institution in which only legal practitioners are entitled to appear, or may draw up or execute any instruments or documents relating to or required or intended for use in any action, suit, or other proceedings in a court. And a person who does not comply with this or contravenes these provisions is guilty of an offence, and quite rightly so. The public need to be protected against people who masquerade or pretend to be legal practitioners. Then we get to forms of legal practice, and that is Clause 34 of the bill. And this is a very important provision, Chair, because it marks a deviation or departure from what is currently the situation. Although the bill is premised on the general rule that advocates must take briefs from attorney, the bill now introduces something that is new and hopefully will promote access to justice and access to legal services. The bill now, and the Portfolio Committee, after comprehensive public hearings, was persuaded to insert a provision of this nature. The bill allows advocates to take briefs directly from members of the public, but in the interest of the public, in the public interest, those advocates can only take briefs directly from the public if they are in possession of a Fidelity Fund certificate, and if they operate their practices with trust accounts as required of attorneys. So that's a deviation from the existing situation. And when advocates enroll with the council, they must indicate upfront whether they wish to practice with or without a Fidelity Fund certificate, and they will be enrolled accordingly. just said, Clause 32 allows advocates to convert from one type of practice to the next. In terms of this clause, I think it's important to point out that advocates won't, if they are going to take briefs directly from the public, the intention is that they will continue to render legal services that advocates traditionally render, and their expertise lies in the field of advocacy and appearing in court. The intention is not to allow these advocates to do the work that attorneys traditionally do, for instance, being executors of deceased estates, being liquidators in insolvent companies. So the demarcation of legal services rendered will remain the same. Advocates will continue to be experts in the field of advocacy and court work. Then another very important clause, Chair, is Clause 35, dealing with fees. It's a contentious issue and it remains a difficult provision. And in brief, and to summarise what Clause 35 says, fees for legal services rendered will, as an interim measure, be determined by the Rules Board for Courts of Law, subject to approval by the Minister. And that is in respect of litigious and non-litigious matters. Chair, at the moment, the Rules Board does determine tariffs in the case of litigious work in court, but it does not determine fees or tariffs in the case of non-litigious matters. So the Rules Board is going to be required, when this bill comes into operation, to determine fees for legal services rendered across the board. And I say it's an interim measure. I will come back to this being an interim measure. But when the Rules Board is going to go about determining fees as envisaged, the Rules Board must take into account a number of factors. For instance, the complexity of the matter at hand, the seniority and experience of the legal practitioner involved, the amount of work involved, and the financial implications involved. What this clause also does, Clause 35, and it's important to note, that it allows the Minister to set a cap in respect of fees payable by the state for legal services rendered at all three levels of government. It's important. The state is the biggest client of legal services and spends an enormous amount of taxpayers' money on legal services. And I think it is only right that the Minister be able to cap those fees payable by the state. Another very important aspect that has been introduced into Clause 35 and was introduced at a late stage in the National Assembly process is that legal practitioners will be required, when they first start interacting with their clients, to give their clients upfront a cost estimate for the legal services required. And the cost estimate must include the processes involved going forward, and this estimate must also set out very clearly that the client has a right to negotiate fees. So many clients go into a legal practitioner's office and they don't realise that they have that right. And it must be spelled out, and this is what this clause requires. Legal practitioners must tell their clients that those clients can talk about negotiating fees. Failure by a legal practitioner to give this cost estimate and to inform the client of his right to negotiate constitutes misconduct and allows the client to refuse to pay until the matter has been resolved by the counsel. This is also a revolutionary provision and hopefully will come to the assistance of the clients of legal practitioners, the general public. Why is the mechanism for determining fees by the Rules Board an interim measure? It's an interim measure because Clause 35 requires the South African Law Commission to launch a comprehensive investigation into the question of fees and to make recommendations on how to address the current challenges. Maybe I should just read what Clause 35 says in that regard. The South African Law Reform Commission must, within 2 years after the commencement of this Act, and investigate and report back to the Minister with recommendations on the following: the manner in which to address the circumstances giving rise to legal fees that are unattainable for most people, legislative and other interventions in order to improve access to justice by members of the public, the desirability of establishing a mechanism which will be responsible for the determining of fees and tariffs payable to legal practitioners, the composition of the mechanism, and the process it should follow in determining fees or tariffs, the desirability of giving users of legal services the option of voluntarily agreeing to pay fees for legal services less or in excess of any amount that may be set by the mechanism contemplated in paragraph C, and the obligation by a legal practitioner to conclude a mandatory fee arrangement with the client when that client secures that legal practitioner's services. In conducting this investigation, the clause goes further, provides that the Law Commission must take into consideration the following: best international practices, the public interest, the interests of the legal profession, and the use of contingency fee agreements as provided for in the Contingency Fees Act. That brings us to the end of the very important provision dealing with fees in respect of legal services. We then go on to Chapter 4 of the Bill, which deals with professional conduct and establishment of disciplinary bodies. I've already indicated that the Council is required to compile a code of conduct for all legal practitioners and all candidate legal practitioners, that is, your attorneys, candidate attorneys and pupils. And importantly, this code must recognize the differences between attorneys and advocates if necessary. What sort of bodies are envisaged? What sort of disciplinary bodies are envisaged in terms of this chapter? There are three bodies, Chair. They are established by the Council. And the first body is an investigating committee, which must, its mandate is to investigate complaints against lawyers and make recommendations to the Council on whether to proceed with the matter or reject the complaint for any reason, for instance, if it's frivolous. The second body, disciplinary body, is a disciplinary committee, and the mandate of this body is to adjudicate on matters that the investigating committees recommend be taken further. And then your third disciplinary body is your appeal tribunals. What are appeal tribunals and what are they there for? Appeal tribunals are there for legal practitioners who are unhappy about the outcome of a disciplinary committee. They're not only there for legal practitioners, they're also there for complainants who made the complaint in the first place, and those complainants are unhappy about the outcome of a disciplinary committee. And they can take these matters on appeal to an appeal tribunal. The disciplinary committees and the appeal tribunals must consist not only of legal practitioners, but also that laypersons must be on these bodies. This is in the interests of accountability and opening up. Emphasis has also been placed in this chapter and on disciplinary bodies and proceedings to make the profession more accountable and to enhance transparency. All disciplinary committees and the proceedings of all disciplinary committees and the proceedings of all appeal tribunals must be held in the public. That doesn't happen at the moment. And what must be made public about these proceedings are the following. The allegations must be spelt out. People must know what the allegations are about. The public must know who the members of the disciplinary committees and the appeals tribunal are. The public must know who the legal practitioners involved are, who the complaints are about, and the public must also know the outcome of the proceedings, including any sanctions imposed. And all of this information must be made public, I think, on the website disciplinary proceedings of any kind, if there are going to be disciplinary proceedings, nothing stops the High Court from intervening in the case of serious allegations. The High Court can step in at any stage, as it does at the moment on application, if there are serious allegations made, and it's in the interests that the High Court deal with these issues on an urgent basis with a view to possibly suspending the legal practitioner or striking his or her name from the role of attorneys or advocates. Yeah, I think I've tried to deal with the key principles. This bill is packed with details. There is so much to talk about. The memorandum on the objects of the bill is also in a reasonable detail. If the committee wants further information, we are available to assist. I'm going to ask my colleague, Ms. Lowe, to do the rest of the presentation, which deals with the remaining chapters of the bill. But if there are questions, we can. But in the interest of time, I see we are already at 11 o'clock, and we are scheduled to finish off at 11:30. So if I may, I'll hand over to Ms. Lowe. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chapter 5 of the bill provides for the establishment of an Office of Legal Services Ombud. This is a new aspect introduced by this bill, and it is hoped that it will be to the advantage of clients as well as the profession. The Ombud will be a retired judge and can hold office for 7 years, which is renewable once. The objects of the Ombud are to protect and promote the public interest in relation to legal services, ensure the proper investigation and disposal of complaints, promote high standards and integrity, and promote the independence of the profession. The Ombud will not have decision-making powers but only recommendatory, similar to the public protector. For instance, the Ombud must investigate and make recommendations to relevant authorities regarding any maladministration in the profession. The Ombud may also mediate, advise and assist complainants. Chapter 6 of the bill provides for the continuation of the current Attorney's Fidelity Fund, but the name is changed to the Legal Practitioner's Fidelity Fund because advocates may now also obtain Fidelity Fund certificates if they decide to practice as such, as was explained previously. The fund, as is the case with the present Attorney's Fidelity Fund, reimburses members of the public who suffered pecuniary loss as a result of theft of their money by legal practitioners. The fund is managed by a Board of Control, which consists of 5 legal practitioners, 2 persons designated by the Council and 2 persons designated by the Minister. All practitioners who take briefs directly from members of the public must be in possession of the Fidelity Fund. And they obtain this annually with a paying of a prescribed fee. So all attorneys must have Fidelity Fund certificates and advocates who choose to practice as such. Chapter 7 spells out how legal practitioners who take briefs and have Fidelity Fund certificates must manage their trust accounts. And these provisions are basically the same as the current Attorneys Act, which is being repealed by this bill. It's more administrative arrangements, there's no contentious aspect, and so it's not necessary to go through that now in detail. State attorneys, as is the case at present, do not need to set up trust accounts. General provisions. In this short chapter, there is a clause dealing with offences and penalties, of which there are several. and it is, for example, an offence for advocates to take direct briefs from the public if they are not in possession of a Fidelity Fund certificate. The Minister must make regulations on several aspects in or after consultation with the Council, and these are aspects in respect of which government has a legitimate interest to ensure that constitutional imperatives are complied with. Rules are made by the Council, and these are aspects relating to the regulation of the profession, administrative matters. The National Forum is provided for in Chapter 10. As Mr. Bassett said at the beginning, this is the incremental, initial, transitional phase that is foreseen by this bill. And Chapter 10 provides for this. The mandate of the National Forum is to deliberate and make recommendations on a number of aspects that still require resolving, and in respect of which there has been no consensus. The National Forum has a lifespan of 3 years. In that 3-year period, it must make recommendations to the Minister on several aspects. For example, an election procedure for the First Council, the establishment of the First Regional Councils, practical vocational training aspects, and some more. And the Minister must then make regulations on this. If the National Forum fails to make these recommendations within a 2-year time limit, the Minister can go ahead and make these regulations. The National Forum consists of 16 legal practitioners, of which 8 are attorneys and 8 advocates. Here there are parity between the two professions, because it is needed for them to pull together and establish all the required things for the bill. There's 1 teacher of law, 2 persons designated by the minister, a person from Legal Aid South Africa, and a person designated by the board of the current Fidelity Fund. The National Forum must negotiate and reach an agreement with the existing provincial and homeland statutory law societies of attorneys. And they must decide what to do with their current assets, liabilities, rights, obligations and staff, whether these should go over to the council or the provincial councils, etc. Non-statutory bodies such as the General Council of the Bar are also given the opportunity to enter these negotiations. The National Forum must report on its activities every 6 months to the Minister and to Parliament. And the Chairperson and Deputy Chairperson are designated by the Minister. The Department of Justice and Constitutional Development is responsible for the expenses arising from the operation of the National Forum, and out-of-pocket expenses by members are to be borne by the body of person who designated that member. The National Forum must appoint an executive officer and supervise the staff, and they can conclude agreements for the performance of any particular act or any particular work. They must determine the remuneration and conditions of service of their staff members and pay an honorarium or an allowance to any person where applicable. Chapter 10 contains a variety of transitional provisions. For example, that existing legal practitioners will be deemed to have been admitted and enrolled under the bill. Advocates with ST status will retain that status, although the bill is silent in this aspect, and pending disciplinary proceedings will be continued with, as if the bill has not been passed. The bill is not a consensus bill in some respects, and hence there is this incremental approach. The National Forum will fulfill a key role in the first phase of implementation, paving the way for the establishment of the permanent council and putting systems and procedures in place. It leaves the destiny of the noble profession largely in the hands of the profession itself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, for the engagement with the presentation. Honourable Zimandia.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the presenters. Just obviously, Chair, because this being a Section 76, which we will have to go provinces for consultations and let provinces mandate the position on the bill. So one is cautious to express a lot of views and opinions as such, but one or two things, Chair, more in the context of clarity. Two similar principles are captured in the bill, in Chapter 10, the National Forum, and I think it's Clause 35 on the Law Reform Commission. It establishes a fixed period for their functioning on various aspects that they are duly empowered to carry out as such. But was it necessary, Chair, that these things be contained in the bill? What in terms of the rationale related to those two? The other matter, Chair, relates to, I can't recall what sections, but it's the area that deals with the composition of the council, earlier in the chapters that Mr. Bassett dealt with, where the minister is given certain powers to appoint people in the council, but then there are conditions that are limiting what the minister could do. One of them is that the people must not be party affiliated, and I'm not sure how implementable is that, and perhaps the rationale would people asked if you have any membership of any party, are these legal practitioners understood to be apolitical, those kinds of some kind of information chain in as far as that is concerned. And related to that is the public servants who are also, I think, precluded to be part of this, if I've heard correctly. And then the state has a full department of practitioners. Some of them are registered and admitted to appear in court. They do a lot of litigation, I'm sure, particularly at the level of province. I know they do a lot, and I think it's the easier case also with the national department. And the departments themselves have legal branches. Almost all the Department of State have the legal branches. who are generally meant by practitioners or people that are qualified in the profession. So, as I said, Chair, these are just observations and by way of clarity, so to speak. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation and also to echo what my colleague has said, Section 76, which is going to be more engaged at the level of provinces. I just want to know, don't know whether it's a process or political matter of approach, to say, was it not easy for the bill to be easily completed as Section 75? Why I'm saying this is that at the provincial level, if we check the way in which legislatures are sort of composed, very little MECs are dealing with judicial matters. Because from magistrate to region to high court, in most cases, the interaction is from the appeal court, high court, and ministry at that level. Very little our legislatures, I'm not sure where we have MECs, but I understand in terms of access to people, the province are well placed to quickly get to the people than public hearing at major level. I just wanted to know, was it not going to be faster as Section 75, but I know I'm not the professor of taking, but I just want to know what is behind that. That's one. Secondly, if this bill must pass before Parliament, are we going to have enough support from the department, particularly technocrats, or I don't know, legal people who will assist, because members will have to go various 9 provinces with people who have more clarity, more real direct, the way the minister was presenting, to assist us on more complex legal questions that might come as we brief them, because you would understand this is law, it's not necessary general politics that we are engaged in. So those are my two questions on order. Thank you.
Mkhodi? Matiza?
No, thank you, Chief. Let us welcome the bill and welcome the briefing. Chair, just on a point that was raised by my colleague here. We know the difficulties we during the appointment of advocates is concerned around this specific issue on people being members of political parties or whatever. And you also know the challenges that we are faced with in the country. If you take what is happening in the Western Cape, if you take what is happening throughout the whole country around appointments of people generally, you know. We also know that generally it was taken that just before 1994, every African person was taken to be politically affiliated to and every white person was affiliated towards, you know, generally that was, because you had a lot of activists representing political detainees, people that were detained through political. I'm not sure as to how we are going to deal with this specific issue if it's contained within the bill itself, because you see, I'm worried about and the challenges that might come out from within the provinces themselves in dealing with this specific matter, because definitely we will have people like Legal Resources Center, people like all these legal groupings that are there within communities coming out and saying, Now, who must be appointed? Are you intending to say people born after 1994 are the people that are suitable to be non-political and whatever? You know, I'm just checking, because it has been a problem all along. And why do we bring that into this particular bill at this point in time? And I think that is the question that has been asked by my colleague here. But let us see what happens. It is there in the bill now. Let us move forward. Maybe if that can be clarified to my colleague in dealing with some of the other areas, we must indicate that we're looking at the bill more or less for the first time. We are going to engage with the bill, and we'll need more clarity from ourselves, even besides the process of going through with some of the issues put forward in front of us today.
Honorable Blue.
Thank you very much, Chair. Very short question. Why not scrapping advocate to be called an advocate? If you are saying that a person can go straight to an advocate. Now, I don't understand, and it's a clarity seeking question, to say that what is the rationale between, and I agree with my colleagues, we'll have more time in interacting with this bill, but I really want to understand what is the rationale. We can get rid of this word advocate and just call them attorneys, all of them.
I just forgot, I remembered the other area, Chair, that I wanted to raise earlier. And that is what Advocate Passett called community service, but it was just, he said, he phrased it that he was branching off, so I'm not sure what he meant by saying that he was is that a matter that is dealt with in reputations? Because one of the aspects there that he raised was that some people will be exempted, and so one would be, I mean, because he was saying no, because other attorneys will be smaller than others, so it would be one person. But I mean, if we are using the same principle as doctors, a new doctor goes to community service, and you don't look at the economies of scale for the person. So perhaps some rationale there, you know, what informs exemptions, to this profession and not to others. So with all of these interim things, Chair, the major question, I think, is some of them are 2 years, some of them are 3 years. So this bill, either way, will be amended with every phase, I think. Is that the proposition? Is that a correct proposition? To understand that in terms of all of these things that are given out to temporary structures or interim structures, it means this bill will be amended every period that structure in terms of this law would then last. There's 2 years for the law commission, there's 3 years for the national forum, because I haven't read this thing, I'm sure there might be other 1 year, 6 months there, 5 years there, 4 years there. So this bill will ever be evolving. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable, I hope this will.
Yes. As the question arises, other issues come to your mind. I just want to, I don't know whether this would be controversial. So if it does become controversial, we still have traditional courts being outstanding. It's also 1576. I'm not legislative, people are talking of parallel justice, traditional justice and civilized justice, something like that one. Thank you.
No, thank you, Chair. I'm covered slightly by Honor Mukoi because I wanted to raise the same question. But I must indicate, Chair, that I want to welcome this particular bill precisely because I know what has happened to a lot of my colleagues who are in this profession. Some black attorneys to date, because of this big fence, could not even qualify, could not go through the processes because they are held back. And I think this bill is trying to deal with some of those particular problems. And that's the reason why I want to welcome the bill, because in a way, it takes away that particular function of people going through what we call this training. You know, that particular training, that it now that training will then sit in a specific board, no longer within that those big companies that are suppressing our own colleagues down there. And that's what I agree upon. But I think the point that was raised by my colleague here was the linkage between this particular bill and the traditional courts bill, because it's a major issue.
Thank you, Chair. I want to check when coming to the issue of attorneys and advocates, is that going to ease the burden to consumers, to ordinary people, when financially? And I'm tempted to ask this, like, for example, when coming to the issue of RAF, where in fact you have to consult an attorney consulting an advocate, but at long last, when coming to the payment, the outcome, all to find that not the big chunk is consumed by the advocate and the like. So which means, and now I think RAF has taken a stand, just that if ever maybe I've got to claim, I can claim straight direct to them, so that now maybe the consumers are going to be eased with going to that burden and the like. So I don't know from the legal perspective, what is it that now as an ordinary citizen that we can benefit from that. Thank you. I'm Jack.
Chairman, I'm just worried about the cost of going to court. The cost is good if the profession is managed, but I don't see a way how we can keep the cost down, as it is impossible for an ordinary man to go to court at this stage. It happens that state subsidizes or anything. Will the state be in a position to go on with that for how long?
My colleagues are going to thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I will deal with a few of the matters. The first one, honourable members raised, related to the period of 2 years for investigation on the question of costs, and there have been some interrelated questions that flowed in the latter part, Chairperson, with regard to that. And I think from the perspective of how to deal with the issue of fees, and how to ensure that in making justice accessible by this bill, that there has to be an informed basis on how the rules board, as is contemplated in the bill, is going to draft fees that deals with tariffs, even extending to non-litigious matters. And this investigation then has a time period that is pegged at 2 years, and the authority to do so has been given to the South African Law Reform Commission. So that before the Rules Board is able to draft tariffs, it's got an informed position within which it can then exercise its mind, based on research that has been done by an independent entity, so that it will be able to draft tariffs as contemplated in the bill. And I think the period of 2 years is sufficiently reasonable, because the interim period in the bill has been envisaged to be a maximum period of 3 years. So in the context of that, the two-year period given to the Law Reform Commission would be an informed basis, and the bill spells out exactly what needs to be done. So, to the question as to what will happen insofar as costs are concerned, and would it be better insofar as access to justice in terms of cost generally? What is the benefit for the ordinary person that is paying legal fees? The bill envisages that much more clarity is going to be sought by the investigation, by the tariffs that are going to be set, and I think from that perspective there will be transparency included. To the public's benefit is the issue of a mandatory obligation for every attorney and advocate to declare up front what are their fees. There must be an agreement that is entered into up front, so that the person that is paying, a member of the public, will have an idea what is the hourly fee rate, what is the cost estimate for this process, so that you can budget, you can make an informed decision. And I think we are aware of challenges the public have, where they could pay the deposit, but a matter takes a year, 2 years to get into a court space, and within a few months, a member of the public doesn't have the necessary funds. So what the bill seeks to do is to create a process in which an informed decision is made about legal costs. So protection for the public, definitely, the bill envisages that process. And the benefits will be that costs will be clearly defined, and you'd be able to know exactly what you're paying for legal services in a more informed basis in terms of this bill. And then the issue of having to, now that the bill talks of allowing advocates to be able to receive monies and receive instructions directly from the public, why don't we just do away with the whole issue of title? I think the history of the bill, Chairperson, and the history of the profession, being, and you will know, and members in this honorable committee will know, that at some stage in the discussions, there were talks of having to fuse the profession. And that was rejected. There were big debates with the legal profession. And that was rejected. And there were the negotiations between the legal profession. And to a large extent, the bill is a compromise bill. We've retained the reference to advocates and reference to attorneys. In an ideal space, I would imagine that the profession should have reference to a legal practitioner, and that would be much more easier. But I think with time, once the bill is passed, with time and the way in which legal services will develop, it might well be down the line that what is envisaged as a legal practitioner and the definition of that, those lines might fall away totally. But for the current purposes, the names of advocates and attorneys are retained in a compromised position. But what the bill fundamentally does, Chairperson, it creates the right for you to bypass an attorney if you seek a specialist litigation practitioner who is an advocate in the higher courts. And you can go directly to him or her, pay him a fee. He or she, the advocate, must have a fidelity fund certificate to protect the public for trust funds. And your fees, presumably, would be limited and be lesser in terms of that arrangement. So you have, in this bill, provision for the possibility of legal fees being lowered by this particular arrangement. So I think for the purposes of where we are in the country, in terms of negotiations over the last 20 years of the legal profession, what Honourable Boom talks to might well be something that will happen in the future. But for now, in terms of where we are, and in terms of having to get both the attorneys and the advocates into one chamber, into one regulated forum, this is what the bill currently does. Thank you.
I'll try and deal with the others. Chair, a few questions were asked about appointment of persons to serve on the council by the minister. And I understand what honourable members are getting at, and there are, it has been suggested that there's a lot of expertise in the department. the legal regarding the legal profession. That is, Chair, this particular provision in its clause 7.3 has also a long history. It's important, and the history, and one has to bear in mind that this bill must not impede on the independence of the legal profession. It's very important. The independence of the legal profession is paramount. So there must not be anything that actually impedes on it, and there should also not be anything that gives rise to that perception. So that's the history of the provision that some of the honourable members spoke about. It is to guard against promote the independence of the legal profession. And there were lots of debates about this. Should the minister, and it revolves around the minister's power to not appoint but to designate people to the council, and there will be three persons that the minister must designate to serve on the council. And it's all relating to the independence of the profession that these safeguards and checks and balances have been put in. The minister may appoint three fit and proper persons who, in the opinion of the minister and by virtue of their knowledge and experience, are able to assist the council in achieving its objects. But that is subject to subclause 3. And subclause 3 provides the minister may not designate a person as a member of the council except a public servant is a member of parliament, any provincial legislature or any municipal council, or is an office bearer or employee of any party, movement or organization of a party political nature. It's important for the independence of the legal profession that politicians are involved or politically motivated people are not involved in the working of the council in the interests of the independence of the legal profession. This provision that I've just read, Chair, is a provision similar to, I think it's one of the provisions in the ICASA Act. So it is already there, but the rationale behind that provision is to ensure that there's nothing that interferes with the independence of the legal profession or is seen to, there's a perception or gives rise to a perception. On the wording itself, a public servant, that is, I think it's self-evident, a member of parliament or an office bearer or employee of any party. That provision doesn't preclude, doesn't stop the minister appointing a person, in my opinion, who is a member of a political party or has political views on something, but must not be an office bearer or employee and must not be a member of parliament. So it's very restricted. I think that's as far as I can take that, Chair. Then there was a question on whether there should be a Section 76 or 75 or and whether the department will be able to provide necessary support when the bill goes to the 9 provinces. So a bit of history on that as well. The department, I was of the view that this is Section 75 bill, as were the state law advisors who certified the bill before it was introduced into Parliament. When bills are introduced into Parliament, I think committee members are all aware it goes to the joint tagging mechanism. And it was there that the bill was tagged as a Section 76 bill. I assume that it was tagged, amongst others, as a Section 76 bill because it was argued, I'm led to believe, that it deals with functional areas of concurrent and national provincial legislative competence which is set out in Schedule 4 to the Constitution, namely consumer protection and possibly trade. So it's a decision that was made by structure in Parliament, not by the department, and we can't do anything about that. It's been tagged, and that is the situation that we've accepted and have to live with. On the question of support from the department, we will try our level best to ensure that we have people when these briefings take place in the various provinces. We have had experiences in the past, and I have to share it. It is sometimes very difficult to deal with it because we've had experiences where briefings take place on similar days in 3 or 4 provincial legislatures, and there are 4 of us in our team, as I said, dealing with the legal practice bill. So that does give rise to challenges, but we will try and deal with it as best we can in the circumstances. And then also, just to respond to Honorable Bloom, Mr. Dyer has already mentioned that. I just want to go back to what I said in the briefing. His question is, why don't we scrap advocates, especially if advocates are going to take briefs directly from members of the public. I did mention in my briefing that even though advocates can take briefs directly from the members of the public, they are restricted to the work of advocates. They cannot go and do work that attorneys traditionally do. So there is still that distinction between the expertise of attorneys and the expertise of advocates. Because Section 34(2) says, an advocate who takes briefs directly from the public may only render those legal services rendered by advocates before the commencement of this act as determined by the council in the rules. So there is still very much a separation of the types of work that advocates and attorneys are going to be doing. On community service, Chair, maybe I dealt with community service in the wrong place. I dealt with it as part of vocational training in my briefing. But community service is there to be performed by admitted legal practitioners as well as candidate and legal practitioners who are undergoing practical vocational training. And there is a provision in terms of which exemptions can be provided. And that provision says the council may, on application and on good cause shown, exempt any candidate legal practitioner or legal practitioner from performing community service as set out in the rules. So the details and the criteria on which exemptions are going to be provided is in the hands of the legal profession, and those will be dealt with in rules that are to be made by the council. There was also a question on community service. Reference was made to community service that is performed by people in the medical profession, doctors. Chair, I don't think one should make that comparison. The community service here, although it's going to be set out in regulations, is not going to be community service as envisaged that the doctors undertake, where they do 2 or 3 years and get paid. Community service for purposes of doing vocational training, if vocational training is as long as it is now, 2 years, articles of clerkship, I would envisage, but I don't want to preempt the regulations that are going to be made because negotiations and discussions are still going to take place on this aspect. I should imagine community service might be a month or so, or 2 months, as part of the 2 years, and not necessarily the whole question of remuneration still needs to be discussed. So the community service that is envisaged in this bill is a far cry from the community service that is undergone by persons in the medical profession. Question was also raised, won't this bill have to be amended because of all the different processes and procedures? Chair, I would argue, no, it's not. There's an interim phase, and that interim phase and the mandate of the National Forum is to come up and make recommendations to the Minister on a range of issues. My colleague has mentioned some of them by way of example. And those recommendations will be converted into regulations, so it doesn't entail, it's not going to entail an amendment to the legislation. And possibly the two that are remaining, the role and interaction between this bill and the traditional courts bill. Chair, the traditional courts bill, as the name suggests, deals with courts and the running of courts. This deals with the legal profession as a profession. And I don't see too much of a linkage between the two. The whole question of the legal profession's role in the traditional courts is still subject to debate. There was a lot of discussions on the traditional courts bill and a lot of opposition to the fact that the traditional courts bill prohibits legal practitioners from operating in the traditional courts. So the traditional courts deals with courts. This deals with the regulation of regulation of the courts themselves. I think the last question was, can the ordinary man go in the street, go to court and pay advocates directly? Yes, I think Mr. Dyer has also answered that. Persons, advocates who have Fidelity Fund certificates, clients will be able to pay the advocates directly without having to work through an attorney. I think those are all, Chair, if I'm not mistaken.
Honourable Landers?
Before Honourable Landers, I just want to clarify something for the committee. Although the bill says you now can go and brief an advocate directly, and that advocate must have a Fidelity Fund certificate, you must remember that there would presumably be a large volume of advocates that would choose to practice the way they currently do, receiving a brief directly from the attorney. So it is, the bill does not do away with that. And I think members must understand that although the bill says you can practice as an advocate who has a trust account, it does not mean that you can't. And whether the overwhelming response by the advocates profession is to retain the current status quo and maybe just a few advocates choose to go the other route is something that we will see how it will be played out. So I just wanted to make the point. It doesn't do away with the current referral rule. In fact, it retains it, but it what it does, it allows an advocate to also decide and make a choice how he or she wishes to practice, in what form. So that is what the bill seeks to do.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity and for allowing me to say a few words to you. I want to address the question raised by Mr. Bloom, because throughout the Portfolio Committee's deliberations on this bill, outside of Parliament, we were confronted by that very same question by people within the profession, and some of them very senior people who I don't want to name here. And essentially, what Mr. Bloom is raising is the fusion of the bar and the sidebar. In order to address the question, I think you need to go back in history. The First Minister of Justice, Stella Omar, took the initiative of engaging the legal profession on this very question. He was met with resistance. His successor, Penrol Maduna, did the same, and again he was met with resistance. Penrol Maduna's successor, Bridget Mabanga, did the same, and she was met with resistance. Until eventually Enver Surti, now Deputy Minister of Education, tried to engage with the profession. And of course, eventually now, the Honorable Jeff Khadebe took the bull by the horns and said to the profession, well, only so far, no more. You've had 20 years. You can't keep saying to me and to the general public out there that things are good in the profession. Leave us alone, we know what we're doing. Now, to address Mr. Bloom's question, there are countries in the world, some of whom are former colonies of Britain, who did away with the two-step or two-tier system of attorney and advocate. United States of America, when it fought and successfully engaged Britain in the War of Independence, kicked out the two-tier system, Jefferson. India doesn't have the two-tier system. It's also a former colony of Britain. Namibia doesn't have that system. It's done away with it. Indonesia, I met with the Indonesian Minister of Justice, and he confirmed that Indonesia, they only have lawyers. They just call them lawyers. They don't call them attorneys or advocates. When a student in law leaves university and does his pupillage, or call it what you will, he then qualifies as a lawyer. What I have not been able to research is whether Indonesia
Indonesia's jurisprudence is based on Roman Dutch law. But there you have it. Chairperson, Britain itself, together with other countries, are re-evaluating the need for such a system. If you go into the British system, you'll find that they themselves have engaged in a process whereby they look very seriously at the matter. I can't say that they have succeeded or failed, but certainly they've looked very hard at the system because they've done so in the public interest as opposed to the interests of the legal profession. And Australia and New Zealand are other countries, both of whom are former colonies of Britain and have also derived their system from the British legal system, are also re-evaluating the system so that it exists and practices in the public interest more than anything else. And what you find, Jefferson, in Clause 35 of the bill is what we have borrowed from the Australian system. We've made no apologies for it. We find it laudable that an attorney must give his or her client a cost estimate of the work he or she intends doing. And that is what's happening in Australia at the moment. Now, you've heard the drafters speak of the incremental approach to change. I think what is in the minister's mind is that it will be important for the legal profession itself to engage in a debate on the fusion of the bar and the sidebar. The national forum is set up to lead to the establishment of the Legal Practice Council. Now, within that council, the legal profession can then engage in the whole question of the fusion of the bar and the sidebar. However, that debate, I believe, must be broadened and include the general public and civil society. But I don't think the advocate's profession and the attorney's profession can get away with hiding behind the excuses they have put forward in the past 20 years, Chairperson. I think it is time for them to engage on this question of fusion of the bar and the sidebar. And we had, amongst other people, George Bizos appearing before the Portfolio Committee. And he reminded the legal profession, who were also present, that over the years, people like him and others had warned them that if they didn't change, then they would be forced to change by people like members of parliament who were sitting before the legal profession. And he said to them, that day has arrived now. And now you're going to see the change which we have pleaded with you to bring about. And some of you may not like some of the steps that may be taken. Now, I'm not saying that the fusion of the bar and the sidebar, which is, by the way, it's ANC policy, okay? I may as well say this, Chairperson. But we've approached it, as we said, in an incremental fashion to allow the legal profession itself to engage on the matter and perhaps come to an amicable conclusion. And we hope that is what's going to happen. As to how long it takes, we're not in a position to say. I trust that serves to answer Mr. Bloom's question and anybody else's in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Landers. Honourable members, I think we'll have time to further engage on the bill, and if I didn't waste of time, I'll allow the department to proceed with the judicial matters amendment.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Roberts to assist in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The general purpose of the additional matters amendment bill is to amend the numerous acts that is administered by the department. And the bill is intended to address practical and non-contentious nature, issues of non-contentious nature. It also affects technical amendments to various acts. Initially, when the law was introduced in Parliament, it mainly consisted out of 49 clauses. It was the impact of Section 75 bill. However, after the bill was introduced, the joint tagging mechanism was considered the bill, and it retagged the bill to a Section 76 bill due to the fact that a few clauses in the bill may affect the provinces. The bill was then split in two bills. The one bill I'm going to deal with first, that is the Additional Matters Amendment Bill, the D version thereof. The other clauses is in the Committee Bill, the Additional Matters Amendment Bill, the Amendment Bill. I'm going to deal with the provisions of the bill now. The first clause amends Section 29 of the Magistrates Court Act. This clause provides that a Magistrates Court have jurisdiction over actions on or arising out of a credit agreement as defined in Section 1 of the National Credit Act. And there is no limit set to the amount that can be taken to the Magistrates Court. However, the Afrikaans text of the section is not in line with the English text, and it proposes that a Minister of Justice may determine an amount. We amend this section in the Magistrates Court Act just to bring the two texts, the Afrikaans and English one, into line by taking the discussion out of the Afrikaans text whereby the Minister may determine an amount. Which will fall in the jurisdiction of Magistrates Courts. Clauses 2 and 3 of the bill propose amendments to Section 50 and Section 50 bis of the Magistrates Court Act. And that is as a result of the Constitutional Court judgment, Maliachi, versus Cape Dance Academy International. In the Constitutional judgment, procedure of arrest tankam suspecte de fuga was declared unconstitutional. And clause 3 further increases the prevailing amount that is determined in Section 50 bis in accordance with the Consumer Price Index to the amount of 2,500 rand. The procedure of tankam suspecte de fuga is mainly where a person may be arrested if there is a possibility that he is going to leave the area of jurisdiction of a court. That's mainly to keep him there. It's not more or less to force him to pay the debt that's owed. It's mainly just to ensure that he actually attend the trial, and that is done away with now. Clauses 4 and 5 merely affect corrections to the Criminal Procedure Act, namely Section 38 and Section 73. Clause 6 amends Section 271B of the Criminal Procedure Act in order to add court orders which were made under Section 291A and B of the Criminal Procedure Act as sentences that qualify for expungement. Non-custodial sentences imposed on children before Section 290 was repealed by the Child Justice Act. It's mainly 291 of the Criminal Procedure Act allowed the court to impose certain sentences on children where they might be kept under the custody of certain persons, and that is mainly just to ensure that sentences can now also be expunged. Clause 7 proposed amendments to Section 271C of the Criminal Procedure Act in order to include further offences that may be automatically expunged by the South African Criminal Record Centre. These offences may be categorised as so-called apartheid offences, which existed before the new constitutional dispensation, and the offences mainly relate to racial segregation and job preservation. Clause 8 of the bill seeks to insert section 271DA and section 271DB in the Criminal Procedure Act. The inserted section 271DA allows the Minister or the Director General of Constitutional Development to revoke a certificate of expungement under certain circumstances, mainly where such a certificate was erroneously granted. The proposed section 271DB authorizes the Director General of Justice to delegate certain powers in relation to expungement to official in the department with the rank of at least Deputy Director General. Clauses 9, 10, 11 and 12 merely seeks to correct certain textual inaccuracies to the Criminal Procedure Act as a result of amendments that was affected later by the Child Justice Act. Clause 13 to 17 propose amendments to the Attorneys Act. Firstly, these amendments relate to organizational efficiency in the first hand. On the other hand, it's mainly to provide to the Attorney Stability Fund certain powers to curb losses that may be incurred by them in respect of theft of monies by attorneys. Clause 18 propose an amendment to the Small Claims Court Act in order to enable a commissioner who was appointed for a specific small claim court to also preside over cases in other small claims court within the same province. This amendment is necessary due to the fact that there is a shortage of commissioners that will actually sit in the rural area of the small claims court. This is mainly just to alleviate that problem. The next set of amendments amend the Judicial Service Commission Act. And that is mainly to address practical issues. The first clause is clause 19, which proposes an amendment to section 83 to provide that a chairperson of the Judicial Conduct Committee may delegate any of his or her powers or functions to the Deputy Chief Justice. Clause 20 proposed that the new subsection 4 be added to section 9 of the Judicial Service Commission Act to provide also for the delegation of powers to other functionary and also to provide for the event where both the Chief Justice and Deputy Chief Justice is not available, so that there can always be a chairperson that will preside over the committee. Clause 21 provides for an amendment to section 14(1) of the Judicial Service Commission Act, which also provides that a chairperson may refer a complaint about the judge to the Deputy Chief Justice to deal with the terms of the provision of the Act, with understanding that the Deputy Chief Justice is seen the role of chairperson in respect of that complaint. Clause 22 to 40 propose special corrections to section 18, 19 and 34 of the Judicial Service Act. Clause 25 propose a textual correction to section 35 of the Judicial Service Commission Act. And it also empowers the Minister to make regulations regarding witness fees that attend a meeting of the Judicial Conduct Committee or the Judicial Conduct Tribunal. In the Constitutional Court case, the Centre for Child Law as Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, certain provisions of Section 51 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act was declared unconstitutional to the extent that they applied to persons under 18 years of age at the time of the commission of an offence. Clause 26 proposed amendments to Section 51 of the Act by excluding an accused person who was under the age of 18 years at the time of the commission of the offence from its operation. Clauses 27, 28, and 29 of the bill seeks to give effect to the Constitutional Court judgment, Bremer versus Minister of Social Development and others, where it was held that time periods that were prescribed in Section 78(2) and Section 77(5)(c) of the Promotion of Access to Information Act were unconstitutional. Clause 27 and 28 increase this time period in accordance with the time period that was recommended in the judgment of 180 days. And clause 29 further, in accordance with the judgment, gives the court power to condone non-compliance with this time period of 180 days, where the interest of justice so require. Clause 30 seeks to insert section 128A in the Children's Act. If a name of a person has been included in a national child protection register as a result of a conviction for an offence provided in the Children's Act, such a person is not qualified for expungement of his criminal record in terms of the provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act. This amendment is merely there to enable the Director General of the Department of Justice to establish whether there is compliance with the expungement requirements and consider an application for expungement of a criminal record. Clause 31 further seeks to amend the table of the content to that act. Similar to the previous discussed amendments, Clause 32 seeks to insert the new Section 44A into the Sexual Offences Act in order to give the Director General Justice the power to obtain particulars from the Registrar of the National Register for Sex Offenders in order to determine whether a person's name appeared on the National Register for Sex Offenders for the purpose of processing applications for expungements. Clause 34, a consequential amendment to the index of the Act to accommodate this amendment. Clause 53 of the bill, reads Section 66289 of the Sexual Offences Act. In terms of Section 66(2), the National Director of Public Prosecution will issue directives relating to the manner in which prosecutors must ensure that the court order, in terms of which it is directed that a person's name must be entered in the National Register for Sex Offenders, are forwarded to and received by the Register of the Register. This provision is actually a duplication of duties, since the Act already in Section 53 provide a place of obligation, rather, on the register of the High Court or clerk of the court, of a magistrate's court, to forward these orders which was made in a criminal case before the court to the register of the National Register for Sex Offences. Clause 35 amends Section 28(2)(b) of the Child Justice Act to provide that the report about any injury to a child or in an event where a child is severely traumatized, that it should be submitted to the Provincial Commissioner. That is the current status which that provision provides. It's further provided that that copy should also be submitted to the National Commissioner. Clause 36 amends Section 43 of the Child Justice Act in order to address uncertainties on which courts should conduct a preliminary inquiry. The amendment is to the effect that preliminary inquiries must be conducted in the district court and the magisterial district in which the offence is alleged to have taken place. Clause 37 merely seeks to correct or effect a textual correction to Section 65(3) of the Child Justice Act. Clause 38 substitutes Section 75 of the Child Justice Act to remove the reference to section 2761I of the Criminal Procedure Act from that section. Section 2761I refers to imprisonment for which a person may be placed under correctional supervision and the discretion of the Commissioner or Parole Board. Section 75 of the Child Justice Act only deals with the sentences of correctional supervision, and that reference to section 2761I should therefore not have been included in section 75 of the Child Justice Act. Clause 39 seeks to effect amendments to section 85 of the Child Justice Act, which deals with automatic reviews in certain cases. The following questions regarding the application of section 85(1) have arisen in our courts, which have resulted that certain magistrates actually sent their own orders on special review to obtain clarity on these issues. These issues that were submitted to the higher courts for clarity was whether, firstly, a sentence imposed in the original court as to whether that would be subject to automatic review. Secondly, when the matters are subject to automatic review in cases where the accused was legally represented. And thirdly, whether non-custodial sentences in the case of children under the age of 16 years should be subject to automatic review. The outcome of most of the special review cases is to the fact that because the Child Justice Act is intended to put in place a special protective measure for children in trouble, in accordance with Section 28 of the Constitution, there is a need to ensure a high degree of scrutiny over sentences imposed on child offenders, and therefore matters emanating from regional courts and matters where children were legally represented should then also be subject to automatic review. Clause 59 merely intends to clarify the above uncertainties. The High Courts have, however, not pronounced whether non-custodial sentences in the case of children under the age of 16 years should be subject to automatic review. It is, however, suggested that it is not necessary to subject the matter in which a non-custodial sentence has been imposed to automatic review. Clause 46 to amend Section 87 of the Child Justice Act, which deals with the expungement of certain criminal records of children. The amendments proposed to Section 87 are similar to those proposed in Clause 8, which deal with the expungement of certain criminal records. Clause 41 seeks to address crucial inaccuracies in Section 100 of the Swana Fix of the Child Justice Act. Clause 42 seeks to effect factual corrections to Section 3 of the Reform of Customary Law of Succession and Regulation of Related Matters Act. Clause 43 deals with the short title and coming into operation of the Act once the bill has become an Act of Parliament. Well, that's mainly all the amendments that is currently in the issue matters. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Landers, can you continue the judicial matters, second and third amendment?
Yes. With your permission, Chairperson, and again I thank you for the opportunity. During our consideration of the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, the committee was seized with the matter of burgeoning sexual offences taking place out there. And during our deliberations on the matter, the question that arose was, what had happened to the sexual offences courts that had been established and that had worked so well? Now, the reason for the demise of the sexual offences courts came about because magistrates who presided in those courts complained that they were suffering from post-traumatic stress.
day after day, case after case, listening to people being raped, children being raped, and this had affected them. And so this had eventually led to the demise of these courts. But the portfolio committee felt strongly that these should be reinstated. And we engaged with the minister and his office and the department. And there was agreement that this could happen, that the resources for these sexual offences courts would need to be found. And they gave the portfolio of the committee the go-ahead to introduce a committee bill, which we call the Judicial Matters Second Amendment Bill. And essentially what it does is it allows the minister to designate a specific court, regional court, as a sexual offences court, and provide the necessary infrastructure for that court to operate as an exclusive sexual offences court. Also, during our deliberations on the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, Chairperson, it was brought to our attention that there were many matters in the bill that affected the provinces substantially. These deal with child justice matters and the Children's Act. It was pointed out that the matters that derived from the Minister and Department of Social Development, insofar as children's matters are concerned, specifically related to provincial matters. We then asked our own research staff and other parliamentary legal experts to look carefully at the bill and to extract for us those clauses that made the bill a Section 76 bill, which they did. We identified seven clauses, and as a portfolio committee, we then resolved that these seven clauses would be taken out of the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill and put into a separate bill, which we now call the Judicial Matters that Amendment Bill, and allow the other 43 odd clauses left in the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill to proceed as Section 75. And we trust that your Select Committee Chair will approve of that process which we've begun and deal with these three bills in that fashion. It will allow certain matters to be speedily expedited by the department and other departments. But at the same time, it will allow your select committee to properly handle those matters that affect the provinces substantially. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Ms. Can we engage with the Peace Honourable Group?
Chairperson, thank you very much. No, I think I will agree that we, the separation of what Mr. Landers have now proposed. And the simple reason for that is everybody can see what is going on in the country now. And we can't delay this thing further. If we are not separating this proposal from them, we are going to have a very serious problem, and it's going to drag for a very long time. I will personally agree with the proposal from the portfolio committee that we separate and deal with this thing head on. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Honourable Matila.
Chair, without wasting time, I think we've gone through a number of all these other processes. We dealt with this. We understand the separation. And therefore, I want to concur with Honourable Bloom that we did go that route. I'm not sure if, because the other thing is we'll only adopt tomorrow. But we don't have a problem to adopt today, so that we deal with the different bills separately and move forward. Great.
Thank you very much. adopted the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill and the Judicial Matters Second Amendment. Yeah. We can adopt now.
Chair, I therefore move that we adopt, as you indicated, Chair.
Honorable Mkhobi?
I would like to suggest, because that is what I'm going to do tomorrow. Yes. The same thing.
Honorable Blue?
Yeah. No, I agree. Let's adopt it today. I see that the ANC is very much in a hurry today. I don't know both of them, but it's fine.
Honorable members, the committee has considered the subject of the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill. Referred to it because that it has agreed to the bill without proposed amendments. That is with regard to the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill. And again, having considered the subject of the Judicial Matters Second Amendment Bill, referred to it because that it has agreed to the bill without proposed amendments. The bills are duly adopted. Honorable members, the last item will be the presentation of the South African Human Rights Commission Bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Labiskafni is here. He's going to deal with that. Substituted to bring them in line with the relevant provisions of the Constitution.
Dose 1 contains definitions of expressions used in the bill and is similar to the existing Section 1 of the Act. However, consequential amendments have been effected to certain of the existing definitions, and a few new definitions have also been inserted. Clause 2 provides for the objects of the bill as provided for in Section 184(1) of the Constitution. Clause 3 of the bill provides that the seat of the Commission will be in the province of Gauteng. Clause 4 of the bill deals with independence and impartiality and is apart from certain amendments similar to the existing Section 4 of the Act. Provision is made that a commissioner of the Commission or a member of staff of the Commission may not use the position or privileges of being a commissioner or a member of staff for private gain or to benefit any other person properly, may not act in any manner that compromises the credibility, impartiality, independence or integrity of the Commission, and any person who contravenes those issues or who fails to comply with any of those matters may be or shall be guilty of misconduct. Chairperson, provision is further made that the commissioners must on an annual basis disclose, among others, their financial interests. Clause 5 of the bill deals with the composition of the commission. Provision is made that the commission will consist of 8 commissioners. It further regulates the qualifications, appointment, suspension and removal from office of commissioners. It increases the number of full-time members from the present 5 to 6, and then further regulates circumstances under which commissioners will be regarded as having resigned. Again, I'm not going to go into too much detail. Clause 6 provides for the mandatory appointment of a chairperson and deputy chairperson of the commission by the president on the recommendation of the National Assembly, and it regulates matters related thereto. Clause 7 of the bill regulates the powers and functions of the chairperson, deputy chairperson and other commissioners. Provision is further made that the chairperson is for exercising or performing his or her powers and functions accountable to the commission, and that the deputy chairperson and other commissioners are for the purposes of exercising and performing their powers and functions accountable to the commission or the chairperson, as the case may be. Provision is also made that the chairperson is for the purposes of the Public Finance Management Act the executive authority of the commission. Clause 8 deals with vacancies in the commission and is, apart from certain amendments, similar to the existing Section 11 of the Act. In terms of the existing Section 11, a vacancy in the commission occurs, for example, when a commissioner dies, he or she is removed from office, or he or she, or his or resignation takes effect. The amendments seek, among others, to create a further scenario where a vacancy in the commission will occur, namely, when a commissioner's resignation, as contemplated in Section 5, takes effect. Furthermore, provision is made that the vacancy in the commission must be filled as soon as possible, soon as practicable after the National Assembly becomes aware thereof. Clause 9 regulates the determination of the remuneration, allowances and other terms and conditions of office and service benefits of commissioners, and is, apart from certain consequential amendments, similar to the existing Section 13 of the Act. Provision is now made that the allowances and other terms and conditions of office
and service the interests of commissioners may not be adversely altered during their continuation in office. Chairperson, in this regard, I can just mention that the bill that has been introduced into Parliament is at presently before the Portfolio Committee, providing for a uniform process to determine the salaries and benefits of all the members of the Chapter 9 institutions. So, that in that bill, provision is made that this clause 9 be repealed.
Proceedings during an investigation or any part thereof. and I quote, if it is in the interest of justice or if harm to any person might otherwise ensue, close quote. And that no person may disclose to any other person the contents of any document in possession of a commissioner or a member of staff or the record of evidence given before the commission during an investigation unless the commission determines otherwise. I just want to mention from this briefing, I think it should be clear to the members of this committee that many of the all the existing provisions all the provisions of the existing Human Rights Commission Act have been incorporating this bill, although some of them have to some extent been amended. That's why apart from certain amendments similar to existing that section. If we now go to clause 16 regulates the powers of commissioners, members of staff or authorized police officers regarding the entering and search of premises and the attachment and removal of articles by virtue of a search warrant or an entry and entry and search warrant issued by a magistrate or a judge of a high court. Provision is, among others, made to empower commissioners, members of staff or authorized police officers to exercise those powers not only in the case of an investigation but also in the exercising of the powers and the performing of the functions of the commission, and clause 16 also extend those powers to include the search of persons and premises, and then it also regulates matters incidental to the exercise of those powers. Clause 17 provides for the payment of witness fees of persons who appear before the commission. In terms of the repeal section 118 of the interim constitution, the commission had to report to the president annually on its activities, and the president had to table those reports in the National Assembly and the Senate, as it was called at that stage. The existing section 15 of that provides for additional reports to be submitted to the President and Parliament by the Commission. Now, if in terms of section 181.5 of the Constitution, the chapter 9 institutions, which includes the Commission, are accountable to the National Assembly and must report on their activities and the performance of their functions to the National Assembly at least once a year. Clause 18 deals with reports by the Commission and is, apart from certain amendments, similar to the existing section 15 which I've just mentioned. Provision is, among others, made for the insertion of the provisions of section 181.5 of the Constitution in order to confirm the requirement contained in that section that the Commission must, in such a report to the National Assembly, also report on the activities of its objectives. Provision is also made that if the Commission makes any finding or recommendation in respect of a matter investigated by it known to the head of the organization or institution or the executive authority of any national provincial department, that head or executive authority must, within 60 days after becoming aware of such finding or recommendation, respond in writing to the Commission, indicating whether his or her organization, institution or department intends taking steps to give effect to such finding or recommendation if any such steps are required. Clause 19. The existing section Section 16 of the Act contains provisions pertaining to staff, finances and accountability of the Commission. As a result of Clause 22, which I will refer to a bit later, and the proposed amendments to the existing Section 19, Section 16 has to be amended in order to provide only for matters relating to the staff of the Commission. The other provisions of the existing Section 16 pertaining to the finances and accountability of the Commission have been included in the proposed Clause 20. Clause 19 is similar to the existing Section 16 as far as pertains to matters relating to the members of staff. Provision is, among others, made to further regulate the appointment, terms and conditions of appointment, and the remuneration, allowances and other employment benefits of a chief executive officer of the Commission, and to provide that he or she must enter into a performance agreement with the Commission, and also to prescribe the responsibilities, accountability, powers and functions of the CEO. It also provides for the appointment, terms and conditions of appointment, and the remuneration, allowances and other employment benefits of the other members of staff. Clause 20, the repealed section 117.2 of the Interim Constitution provided for the deferral of expenditure incidental to the exercise and performance of the powers and functions of the Commission. Whilst the existing Section 16 of the Act also contains provisions pertaining to finances and accountability, Clause 20, which is a new clause that deals with accountability, provides that the CEO will be accounting officer of the Commission and that he or she will be charged with the responsibilities referred to in the PFMA. Clause 21 provides for legal proceedings against the Commission and is apart from a few consequential amendments similar to the existing Section 17 of the Act. Clause 22 deals with offences and penalties and is, apart from certain consequential amendments, similar to the existing Section 18 of the Act. However, a further offence that could be committed in respect of the Commission is created, namely, where a person discloses to any other person the contents of any document in the possession of a Commissioner or a member of staff of the member of staff, or the record of evidence given before the Commission during an investigation without the Commission's permission. Clause 23 deals with regulations. The existing Section 19 of the Act provides that the President may, after the Commission has made the recommendation, make regulations regarding various matters relating to members of staff, for example, the different categories of salaries that will be applicable, the requirements for the appointment, the hours of attendance. It is, however, argued that the President should not be burdened with the determination by means of regulations of those day-to-day administrative functions of the Commission, and that it should rather form part of the functions of the CEO. Clause 23 is similar to the existing Section 19 of the Act, except that it does not contain certain matters relating to members of staff that are regarded as day-to-day administrative functions. Furthermore, the word President is also substituted with the word Minister, the effect of which is that the President's power to make regulations relating to members of staff is transferred now to Cabinet member responsible for the administration of justice. Clause 24 provides for the repeal of the Act and also provides for additional arrangements that are required as a result of such repeal. And then lastly, clause 25 contains the short title and provides for the commencement of the new act. Chairperson, that is as far as the contents of the bill are concerned. And I don't think there's anything else that I, as far as the contents are concerned, need to bring under the attention of the committee at this stage.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, you can engage with the presentation. Honourable Zimande.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just clarity on on this clause on regulations. When it says staff, it means even what, the security guards, the cleaner, or does it state at what, I mean, at what level? Because I think what what the presenter said in terms of the debate on day to day, I'm not sure whether it's even desirable that the minister deals with administrative day to day administrative matters in relation to staff management, staff relations, that kind of thing. So it's just the clarity they share in terms of when they refer to staff. Does it categorize levels of staff? Now, just an old one, Chair, and I think just for the benefit of the committee to keep reminding ourselves, Chair, this referral to the National Assembly, is it to do with what the Constitution, the current Constitution, is saying? Referral to the National Assembly, and that's why it's kept when the bill is being totally repealed. Just a clarity on that aspect too. Thank you, Chair.
Maybe just before some recommendations, just to understand the rationale behind the composition and clause 6 says the chairperson and deputy chairperson must be full time, but the composition is 11 members. What is the rationale behind that? It means, it says 6 full time, chairperson and deputy, you make them at 8. Because in clause 5, I see that. Clause 5 deals with the composition of the commission and states that the commission consists of 11 members who may be appointed on a full-time or part-time or full-time basis for a term as set by the president, but not exceeding 7 years.
Then what are the rationale? Why so many? Thank you.
Honorable Bloom.
Chairperson, thank you.
Why are we involving the president in this bill? I can't understand that. Why not the minister or the CEO? Maybe the act is saying that, and I don't know, but that's a clarity question.
You can respond.
Thank you. First question, whether it's incident with the Minister of, which will eventually be the Minister of Justice. I'm not 100% sure what the question about categories of staff are, because the regulations will apply to all the staff members of the commission, from the CEO up to the lowest level or lowest rank. So I don't know whether that addresses the question. Then the second question, referral to the National Assembly, why we refer to the National Assembly is because in terms of the Constitution, the Commission is accountable to the National Assembly. So that's why reference is made from to the National Assembly. Thirdly, the number of commissioners. Chairperson, provision is made that the commission will consist of 8 members. Not 11, only 8 members. If I can just get a copy of my book quickly. Thank you. And those 5 provides the commission consists of 8 members who must, and then we set out certain requirements. The commissioners may, on the recommendation of the National Assembly, be appointed as full-time or part-time commissioners and hold office for fixed term as the National Assembly may determine at the date of such appointment, but not exceeding 7 years, provided that not fewer than 6 commissioners are appointed as on a full-time basis, and not more than 2 commissioners are appointed on a part-time basis. So again, it's clear that it's only 8 commissioners. The last question by Mr. Bloom, why involve the president in this dilemma? I'm not sure to which specific provisions he is referring. Perhaps if he can give me an indication, then I can respond. But we must keep in mind, as far as the appointment of commissioners are concerned, that is also regulated in the Constitution, where the president appoints commissioners on the recommendation of the National Assembly. That is in section 190. So if it's only about the appointment involvement, then that is in order to give effect to the provisions of the Constitution.
Mujak, Honorable Mokobi, before you, Mr.
No, I just want to make follow up, because he has clarified about 8 members, and the other document I'm here with, it talks of 11 members. Maybe it's a reconciliation. So that one is correct, it's constitutional, but maybe this one is another document. We just have to get the reconciliation. Or maybe our second task, is it the effective? Because it will mislead our argument if you were not getting proper.
No, the mistake is not from the department. It was during when the content advisor compiled it. It says it.
Okay.
Okay.
Your papers, I just want to confirm that the bill as adopted by the National Assembly, B5B, clearly provides that the commission consists of 8 commissioners.
Honorable Jack, and then Honorable Matita.
Chairman Bloom, I've got a problem that we get presentations on these bills today, and tomorrow we must decide on them. I'm not a legal. I'm struggling to. The time is too short, the time frame is too short for me.
I'm objecting against it.
No, Chair, I think I agree. In future, we don't need this type of arrangements that the bill is presented today and whatever, we've not gone through it. But hence some of the mistakes that come in with the different things that are throwing. But seeing that there are no major issues within the bill itself, you know, was just to make sure that certain issues that were given to the president are taken away and given to a minister, because the president can't deal with determining issues of staff up to a security level or a cleaner and whatever. We don't have a problem with that particular process, Chair, and I want to push and the committee members that seen that this bill has gone through the National Assembly and that there's an agreement within the National Assembly around the bill, that as this committee, let us agree, because even if we want to engage, there isn't much for us to engage with this particular bill. It was just to repeal those small matters and therefore move that we adopt this particular bill, Chair.
Before you talk, Honorable Blue, do you want to say nothing, Mr. Bassett?
Chairperson, yes, on the short notice, I just want to inform the committee that this bill was passed by the National Assembly last week, Wednesday, the 30th. So it's not an issue that it was passed
a few weeks ago,
it was only passed last week, Wednesday.
Maybe they're discussing it now, maybe something happened after.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry, I'm only coming in now. Chair, there's been a very recent Constitutional Court judgment as well. I think that this week it was after the National Assembly even approved this bill. And I just want to alert committee members and maybe to give it some thought. Clause 16.6 gives the Commission the power to enter and search premises without a warrant. And I have a feeling that that Constitutional Court judgment that came out in the last day or two has a bearing on this, and I haven't had a chance to study that Constitutional Court judgment, but it might be advisable to just have a look at that particular aspect. It might make subclause 6, giving the Commission the power to enter and search premises without a warrant, problematic. What would then stay if this should go, the committee decides that the Commission can, in any event, search and seize with a warrant of arrest, but I'm concerned about that recent, very, very recent Constitutional Court judgment where there are no warrants. I owe it to you to bring that to your attention, Chair.
Yeah, Honourable Landers.
Yeah, Chair, we want to agree with Mr. Bassett because that was in relation to SARS. But the search and seizure provisions are identical, if not very similar. In SARS, the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, and believe it or not, even the Gender Commission. And within the Portfolio Committee, there was concern expressed about this provision. A member spoke of, imagine the Human Rights Commission going into a place of worship and breaking down the door. It doesn't sit well with anybody. And without realizing that the Constitutional Court will be making a judgment this week on SARS's provision relating to search and seizure. And so if I have the means to do so, I would urge you to look seriously at that and if necessary bring about the necessary changes, because it's a court judgment, the Constitutional Court.
Chairperson, maybe we must just sit as a committee and look at what came out now before we adopt the bill. Let us discuss it and we can still adopt it with amendments. That is what I will propose. But there was a question that I must give clarity. You see the last page. The last page that say that the president must make regulations regarding various, that is, I don't think that the president must be involved, honestly. Let the CEO or the minister,
make regulations, but not the president.
Yeah, Chair, I think that that's a very serious matter. And therefore, I think it is important because I thought, and hence this issue around bills coming before us, and we haven't gone through them properly, you know, and we're asked to rush through them, you know, as in terms of the concern that has been raised here. Rather, we relook at this particular matter, that we go back, because there's a date set for tomorrow for us to look at all these other bills, so that we can finalize this particular matter. Rather that we go back and consult properly and look at the particular bill and come back tomorrow, you know, and deal with this particular matter, Chair. Because I'm worried that it might be this particular issue that has been seen, and there's other matters within the bill, you know, that might be unconstitutional, you know. We rather be tread very careful and look at the bill properly, Chair. And I agree with Member Bloom that we then come back and then look with this particular matter. I want to therefore then withdraw the proposal I made earlier that we adopt the bill, because clearly we haven't read the bill itself ourselves, because we were very busy last week. We just went through this and left and came back this morning to deal with all these other matters. Thank you, Chair.
The parliamentary legal advisors here, we will request her to provide us with an opinion tomorrow before we adopt. Honourable members, this brings us to the end of the business, and I request members to stay. There is a message from COPTA that has been sent. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
That's what you want.